I grew up in Florida. Except for a short time in the Coast Guard, I have lived here all my life. Therefore, I know very little about snow and ice, and even less about the mountains and climbing them. Unless they are titled Space, Splash, or Big Thunder. The only snow I like is in a cone, with mango flavoring, but I never let my ignorance stop me from helping someone. I was in the animal kingdom, conducting surveillance. I'd been hired by the lawyer who represented a mother going through a custody battle with her ex-husband. This is the best way to get hired, because even if you do not get the results that support the case, they pay you. Lawyers bill the customers, and I do not have to worry about getting stiffed. A law firm that bilks a private investigator is likely to run out of gumshoes to hire really quick. There are just not that many of us. But like I said, I was doing surveillance and not getting the results the mother wanted. She wanted to prove the father took the kids on vacation, spent all the time paying attention to his new girlfriend and her kid. If anything, the father spent more time with the kids than he did with the girlfriend. She would stay back at the room and read by the pool. The dad spent the day in the parks playing with the kids. I had just gotten some great pictures of the dad and kids on Kali River Rapids, having a blast. I even got to hit the button squirting them with the elephant trunk at the end of the ride. They were heading towards Expedition Everest, I imagined to dry off, when I saw something that stopped me dead in my tracks and brought my surveillance to an end. Carlos was the son of a former client. The client was his mother and a cast member whom I had helped find something she had been accused of stealing. Not on Disney property, as I draw the line at messing with Disney's internal affairs when it comes to their employer-employee relationships. Carlos had helped me out with a few errands when helping his mother out, and I liked the kid. I had seen him a few times since then, and he was the nicest kid around. So what was he doing clocking the comings and goings of cast members in the fast pass lane on Expedition Everest? I only had to watch him for about 10 minutes to figure out what was going on, as I did the same sort of thing when I was conducting surveillance, albeit not so obviously. I walked up to him and he smiled at me and I feigned a smile as I grabbed him by the upper arm and gave it more than a friendly squeeze and said quietly, "Don't cause a scene and come with me." Luckily, he did not make a scene and closed his little notebook and walked alongside me till we were on the bridge between Disneyland and Asia. That is where I stopped and raised an eyebrow in a stern, questioning manner. "What are you doing?" "Nothing," Carlos said unconvincingly. I folded my arms across my chest and shook my head. Game recognizes game. He was about to deny his activities again, but I stopped him with a held-up hand, not wanting him to entrench himself deeper in denial. "You were conducting surveillance on the cast members manning the fast-pass lane." His face showed I had uncovered his activities plainly. "And doing it in such an obvious way, someone was going to catch you at it in another 5 minutes. And then they would have called security and said there was a suspicious person." My pronouncement shook him a little. "Security would have asked you for your park pass, which I'm guessing is an official guest pass tied to your mother's name. And the next thing you know, your mother comes home with, at the minimum, a written reprimand on her permanent employee record." Carlos had the good sense to look both shocked and embarrassed, and I saw him giving up the lying right then and there. "I was that obvious?" I chuckled. "You were only 20 feet away from the target. You had a notebook and kept looking at your watch when writing stuff down. To tell you the truth, I am surprised you were not invited backstage already." "I only started 10 minutes ago," Carlos said, showing me his notebook. I reached out and took the 99-cent notebook out of his hand without even opening it and walked to the closest trash can and threw it away. I gave Carlos a buck I fished out of my money clip without an explanation. Then I leaned against the railing and continued. "Okay, I know I'm going to be sorry, I ask, but why were you tracking the cast members?" Carlos now looked happy. "I met this girl yesterday."
"Yesterday?"
"Well, last night, Candace was really pretty and we started talking." I held up my hand and Carlos stopped. I ran my fingers through my hair. I got a feeling this is going to require a drink in AC. We left the Animal Kingdom via bus and ended up at the Animal Kingdom Lodge in their quick service area. I grabbed a beer and bought Carlos a Coke. I picked out a table in the corner away from the hustle and bustle. Luckily, it was mid-afternoon, so most people were still in the parks or at the pool, cramming as much recreation into their vacation as possible. "Okay, tell me about Candace," I said once we were situated. The next 20 minutes he outlined what she had told him and how she asked for his help in stealing an item from the ride queue at Expedition Everest. Carlos let slip that he had a PI friend who taught him about surveillance and it needed to be done before any real heist could be conducted. I rolled my eyes at that. I had told him a few things about surveillance when he had helped me out with his mother's case. I guess I forgot to tell him about positioning and doing things in a covert manner, but I had no idea an 11-year-old would try and use that knowledge 4 years later. Carlos was a good kid, but he would not be the first good kid led astray by a pretty face asking him to do a dumb thing. I needed to meet this Candace and get to the bottom of the story. Maybe fill in a few details as to why she would want him to steal from Disney. Carlos said I would meet her at his house tonight as she was coming by for dinner. My ears perked up. A meal at the Lopez house? His mother made the best tamales I had ever tasted, and I hoped they were on the menu. Carlos called his mother and cleared it with her, and I went back to the park to see if I could pick up the trail of my family, though I thought I had enough billable photos for the lawyer. Even lawyers do not like to pay for photos that do not back up the narrative they are trying to portray in court. I arrived at the Lopez home at 6 p.m. sharp. I went up and was about to knock on the door when it was thrown open by Carlos's younger brother, who grabbed the cake I had brought and ran to the kitchen, leaving me standing there. As I entered, Grandma gave me a kiss on both cheeks and said, "Muy guapa." The rest of the meal was one of fun chaos, with unfortunately no tamales, but Carlos's mother had made tasty burgers and fresh corn on the cob, which was a great meal for a guy who lives alone. Candace came in just before we were seated, so I was not able to engage her in a one-on-one conversation. I did discover over dinner she worked for Carlos's mother, Vivian, as a college program cast member, and Carlos had met her at the welcome party his mother had thrown the night before. It was not until after dinner, when Carlos's little brother left and Abuela went to watch TV in a room, that we got down to business. I wanted Vivian to sit in on the conversation, and when Carlos told her what I had caught him doing, I could see her begin to boil. I was able to release some of the steam when I assured her he was not caught doing anything by Disney security, and that is when Candace spoke up. "I am really sorry that you thought I was serious. I thought you were joking when you said we could steal the ice screw," Candace said. Then she turned towards Vivian. "I was very emotional last night, as I had just found the ice screw earlier in the day, and I guess I got carried away with a crazy scheme, and then Carlos said he knew about surveillance and planning." She then faced Carlos. "I am sorry you thought I was serious." I saw a tear run down her face, and suddenly the girl said, "Excuse me," and got up and practically ran to the bathroom. Vivian looked over her son, frowning. "If your father was home, he'd probably have given you a good smack. And since when do you think you know how to steal things?" Carlos mumbled something under his breath, and his mother said, "Speak up." "I watched Ocean's 11 a bunch of times. I figured, how hard could it be?" I tried not to laugh, but a snicker came out, and Vivian stared daggers at me. My mouth still broke and my laughter came out. Luckily, my laughter was infectious and Vivian started laughing, and then Carlos did as well. Vivian got up from the table and started to walk to the bathroom to retrieve Candace, but she turned around and came back to Carlos, gave him a soft cuff along the side of his head and said, "Ocean's 11," while rolling her eyes. A short while later, Vivian came back with Candace and I took charge. "Okay, Candace, tell us the story from the beginning. And what is an ice screw?" The story went as follows. "I grew up in Colorado, and my brother Richard loved climbing, a self-labeled and proud climbing bum. His world revolved around climbing, lived in a van, taking odd jobs in various locations just so he could be close to climbing. One Christmas, when I was 5, he was home. He explained to me about climbing frozen waterfalls and glaciers using ice screws. I did not know much about climbing, but I knew he could fall unless he used ice screws. I was scared for him, and I thought I could do magic, and stole one of his ice screws from his van. I snuck into the garage and painted the ice screw gold with a can of spray paint I found. My dad caught me, and instead of punishing me, he helped me clean up and wrap the ice screw as a present. Richard loved the magical ice screw, and for the next couple of years he carried it with him everywhere. It became a running joke over the years, and he would always tell me he had his magical ice screw, and he would be safe on his next climb. Richard got his dream job guiding trekkers in Nepal. During his second season in Nepal, we got the bad news. Richard, while doing a supply run to Lukla from Everest Base Camp, he was killed in a traffic accident. My family was devastated, and when the family received Richard's gear along with his body, everything except the magical ice screw was there. We talked to his friends, we even talked to some people he guided, and no one ever knew what happened to the gold-painted ice screw. They all said he had it in Nepal, and whenever he went anywhere with his backpack, it was mounted on the outside of it. We never discovered what happened to it. But yesterday, while going through the fast pass line at Expedition Everest, I looked up, and there it was, hanging on the wall in the gear shop. Candace showed us a picture of Richard holding the ice screw on the top of El Capitan in Yosemite. The picture was in full color and had great detail to it. It was evidence in my mind that if the screw in the gear shop matched up, then a case could be made that it was the one that belonged to Richard in Nepal. I knew Disney went in for as much authenticity as possible. I remember seeing an interview with the head Imagineer, Joe Rohde, talking about bringing artifacts back from the Everest for the queue. So the chain of custody was there, at least from Nepal to Disney's Animal Kingdom. I was lost in thought when Vivian poked me. Everyone around the table was looking at me. "Do you think you can prove it is Richard's?" Candace said. I looked around the room and nodded slightly. "Maybe. Let me talk to some people." I slept in the next day, no casework, except for sending my findings to the law firm and sending an invoice. My office greeted me with bills stuck in the slot, which I pointedly ignored, and sent off my own bill, which I hoped would not be ignored. I looked up a number for an acquaintance that worked for Imagineering. I received a text back soon afterwards saying we would meet for lunch as she was in Florida. "How you been?" "Great. Down here for a bit, then back to California in a couple days." "Where are they putting you up this trip?" "The Contemporary. It's not the Grand, but it's not the All-Stars either." This was a running joke between us. I'd met her when I was working a case at the All-Star Movie Resort and stuck up a conversation with her in the food court. I did it mostly as a cover for surveillance, but when I learned she was an Imagineer, we swapped contact information. Lunch went well. We caught up on things and talked about our jobs. It finally got down to why I called. "Something I can help you with, Miles?" she asked as the waitress refilled her drinks again. I told her about Candace and about Richard passing away in Nepal. I was wondering if we could get the background of an item, something mounted on the wall of the attraction. "It's not a museum piece, is it? Because that is another department than what I do." I waved my hands. "Not a museum piece. In fact, I think it can be touched by the guest." "Oh, well then that is my area," Casey said, smiling. "Give me the details," Casey said, getting out her notebook and pen. I liked her professionalism. "Expedition Everest, fast pass queue. The item is an ice screw." I paused while Casey caught up with her notes. While she scribbled, "I wonder if there's an ice nut or an ice nail. With gold spray paint on silver-colored metal. That is all you got?" I looked at her confused. "Why, do you need more detailed description?" Casey gave an embarrassed laugh. "No, I was being sarcastic. I thought this was going to be difficult. Usually when I get a request, it's a lot more ambiguous, and the person can't tell me anything except the basic location, maybe its color." "Oh, you want me to be more vague so you can be challenged," I said jokingly. "Okay, it's a thing hanging on, whatchamacallit, in that land with all the green trees." "That would be harder," Casey said, laughing, and now closing her notebook. "Give me a day or two, and I will tell you what I can about it." We said our goodbyes, and I went back to my office to do research. Research meant going through videos and articles about Joe Rohde and his Imagineers who built Expedition Everest. There are a few clips of the Imagineers' trip to Nepal, but not much else. I learned a lot about the ride, but as far as finding a picture of Joe Rohde picking up an ice screw with Richard the climbing bum in the background, I was a no-go. The rabbit hole was entertaining, and I did learn a lot about trekking in Nepal and about how Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay climbed the Goddess of the Sky. Norgay started a successful climbing and trekking business. Hillary devoted a good portion of the rest of his life teaching around the world about environmental awareness and helping people of the Himalayan region by building schools, hospitals, and dental clinics. I leaned back in my chair and let my brain rest and was rudely woken by a ringing telephone, and I was given another job. This one a paying gig. It was a few days later that I got back to the missing ice thingy when I got a text from Casey and met her for lunch at The Wave. The Wave is a little bit expensive, so I just opted for French fries. Casey's job with Imagineering was as a database manager. Casey and her partner, a photographer, traveled to new rides and attractions and documented everything right before the ride opens. And when I say everything, I mean everything. If it is a permanent fixture, a light switch, a fan, a security kiosk, a picture is taken and put into a database with proper labeling. That way, if something is damaged or they want to duplicate the ride or hotel on another continent, it can be done with almost eerie precision. Imagineers leave nothing to chance, ever. I heard a story about the droid depot at the Star Wars area of studios. Before it was opened officially, the Imagineers were doing the finishing touches. They went into the droid depot, which is supposed to be a hodgepodge of components and half-finished robots. The area behind the conveyor belt was a jumble of parts and pieces. The Imagineers took down the bits and fragments that were already there and meticulously recreated the layout they had drawn up, down to the last robot arm, nut, and bolt. Imagineers have a plan for everything. Not saying they are perfect, even the best laid plans sometimes go amiss. Ask the Yeti on Everest if you do not believe me. Joe Rohde and his team made the biggest audio animatronic in the world at 25 feet tall, moving vertically and horizontally with moving arms covered in yak hair. But something went wrong, thus his inactivity since 2009. Casey handed me her tablet after the meal was over, and she let me see the extract of the document. There's a list with other items, was a description of an ice screw, 16 centimeters long, with old gold paint on it, and found at a second-hand shop near Nacha Baza La Pali. I handed the tablet back to Casey. Well, that is good. At least we know the ice screw came directly from where Richard was, but we do not know how one of his few prized possessions got from his hands into a second-hand shop. Sorry I could not help you more, Casey said. Hey, you helped me a lot. This might just be one mystery that will never be solved. At least let me pay for your lunch, Casey said as she waved to the waitress for the bill and signed off charging it to her room upstairs. I kicked myself mentally for not taking advantage of the Disney per diem by ordering a hamburger. I broke the news to Candace and Vivian that night as they were getting off work. Carlos just happened to be nearby, typical young man who had a thing for a pretty lady. Unfortunately, I saw that the older college woman had placed Carlos in the dreaded friend zone. But like most young men, hope springs eternal, at least until they are attracted to the next object of affection comes along. That is all the Imagineers have on the ice screw, I said, closing my notebook. Candace's face was neutral, and Vivian, her boss, put a hand on her shoulder for comfort. Candace smiled at the gesture, then spoke. Well, I think it is Richard's, but I guess there is no way to prove it, she sighed. But it's good to know that it made its way back to a place my family can see it. I saw a look across Carlos's face. The idea of stealing was just about to come out of his mouth again, and I gave him a scowl and sent a mental message to him. Don't be stupid. I saw that he got the message, which proved not only was he a good kid, but he was smart enough to read others' expressions. The only thing I can think of now is to travel to Nepal, talk to the shopkeeper, but there is no guarantee he or she would even remember the ice screw and where they got it. I said, sadly, that I could not help Candace out even further. Candace sighed. Thank you for all your help, Mr. Mitchell. You did something extraordinary already, simply confirming where the ice screw came from and all. I'm going to call my parents now. A few months later, I was leaving Epcot via the monorail. I had borrowed my best friend Danny Dewey's car for an overnight surveillance on a no-tell-motel case. I was heading to the Ticketing Transportation Center to catch a Lynx bus to get to my office. I was walking up the ramp to the platform after handing Daniel the keys when I glanced over and saw a tourist in a red t-shirt with a slogan for the American Himalayan Foundation. I'm not sure that I believe in God, big or little g, karma or fate. I do believe that if you pay attention in life and listen to that little voice in the back of your head, good things happen. That little voice helps you, especially when you're trying to do good for others. Being in a bit of a daze due to lack of sleep, I did not put two and two together very quickly. The man had a shirt about Nepal on it. I could not ever recall seeing a Nepalese shirt, flag or indication that someone had been there to the region in the park before. This could mean something, my little voice said. Unfortunately, the little voice came to this conclusion as his doors closed on the monorail and I started the 6-minute trip back to TTC. I panicked. I do not know why, but I knew I had to talk to this guy. I reached for my phone. Daniel, I need a favor. I just let you borrow my car overnight. What do you want now, my left arm? Just shut up and listen. White guy, 40s, white bucket hat, red t-shirt that says American Himalayan Foundation. Probably just went through the turnstiles. I thought you did not have any cases in the park today. Just find that guy and keep an eye on him till I get back from TTC. I made the turnaround from the TTC. I stayed on the monorail as it returned to Epcot. As soon as I got beyond the touch points, I called Daniel, joined him in the land pavilion. He made a lot of noise about how many I owed him, and I promised him a really good lunch somewhere, the naming rights to my firstborn, and a kidney if he needed one. It was after all these promises were made that he pointed to the man and his family sitting in the revolving garden grill, currently having lunch with Farmer Mickey Mouse and his pals. Daniel walked off, muttering how my son would be named Dewey Mitchell, or if it was his daughter, Danielle Mitchell. I ignored him and found a place to wait until Red Shirt Man finished his lunch. Candace, this is Doctor of Dentistry, Jerry Counts, and he has a story he wants to tell you, I said, introducing Candace, who had joined us in the corner of the Polynesian lobby where the good doctor was staying. Candace smiled and the doctor began. I volunteer with the American Himalayan Foundation. I've traveled to Nepal numerous times and donated my time as a dentist to help the people out. Candace nodded. My first trip, I did time at a bunch of clinics, and my last in my rotation was at Namche Baza. The clinic was run by a Nepali dentist, and I was there to lend a hand. My first patient was a little boy who would not sit down in the chair until after a few hushed words with the technician, and she handed him something which he held as he hopped into my chair with no problem. After I did my exam, finished up with the demonstration how to brush his teeth, his mother led him out of the room, but he turned and handed me the thing he had gripped so tightly during the procedure. I watched Candace for this next part. Little boy handed me an ice screw painted gold. Candace gasped, and her eyes got wide. The doctor continued. A couple years before I got there, there was another dentist at the clinic. It seemed that one day an American carried a little girl that had been kicked by a donkey and she had some severe teeth damage. The little girl clung to this American and he stayed with her until the anesthesia kicked in. Somehow the little girl had latched onto his old gold ice screw even when she was under. She clung to it tightly. Candace simply nodded. The American told the girl's parents she could keep it as a good luck charm, but he would return in a couple days to get it back. As it was a gift from his sister, would keep her safe as it had kept him safe climbing all these years. I looked at Candace, whose eyes were watering now. Mine were blurred. Damn allergies. The American never came back, and when the little girl recovered and she passed it along to another child who came in crying. Each dentist was told the story about the American and the gold ice screw, and it seems that children told each other about the magical ice screw. The doctor paused for breath. The clinic was destroyed by an earthquake, and the gold ice screw was lost. We think it might have been taken by somebody collecting scrap. Candace turned and hugged me. It really was magical. The best kind of magic, I said, hugging her back.